it please this honorable court. This morning, we turn our attention to an issue arising out of a civil trial case and the relation between the jury instructions, the verdict form, and the trial court's application of apportionment to the judgment. This case concerns a motor vehicle accident that occurred on the island of Maui on November 2, 2001. The collision was caused by the negligence of the defendant appellee, Frederick Funari. The plaintiff appellant, Irene Kato, was injured as a result of the collision and brought suit against defendant Funari. The trial began on September 27, 2004, and the case was submitted to the jury on October 6, 2004. The jury returned its special verdict in the case on October 7. Before beginning their deliberations, the jury was clearly instructed on the law by the trial court. They were instructed that they were to consider the issue of apportionment and to limit the damages that they awarded to only those which were legally caused by the defendant's negligence. At the defendant's insistence and over plaintiff's objection, the court included apportionment-type questions on the verdict form. After receiving the jury's verdict, and at the time of entering judgment, the court applied a 90% reduction to damages award that had already been apportioned and reduced by the jury. That had the effect of taking away all of the damages that had been awarded by the jury to Mrs. Kato. And that is the reason why we are here today. We are seeking to have the error reversed and the judgment vacated. We start off with the jury instructions that were given and that were provided to the jury in this case. In particular, today we highlight jury instructions 26, 30, and 31. These were all the Supreme Court's standard jury instructions on damages as modified in this case. Instruction number 26 is the court's standard instruction 8.9. Instruction number 30 was the court's standard instruction 8.11. And instruction 31, the Montalvo instruction, which is going to be critical to our analysis this morning, was the court's standard instruction 7.3. These instructions were submitted and agreed to by both parties. It's important that today there does not appear, based on the briefings and the arguments that have been presented up to this point, any question about the instructions themselves as whether or not they were warranted, whether they were applicable, whether they were correct and true statements of the law. Neither the appellant or the appellee are challenging these instructions. It's the application of these instructions to the eventual verdict form that is at issue. Let's go through some of these instructions, the highlights, and look at how they apply to the facts and application of this case. As you will see, each of the instructions, 26 and 30 and 31, are all consistent in what they require from the jury. In instruction number 26, this is the instruction that defines damages to the jury. If they get to the point where they found that defendant Funari's conduct was a legal cause of Irene Kato, then they must consider damages. And the court is giving them guidance and definitions of what constitutes damages and what they are to consider when they determine how much damages, if any, to award. And they are told that they are to consider Irene Kato's injuries as a result of the accident. These points are going to become very important, as you will see. They are not asked to determine the totality of Irene Kato's injuries from pre-existing conditions or from conditions that may be unrelated to the accident. They're taught and told that they are to consider her injuries which are as a result of the accident, and that the plaintiff is entitled to damages which, in the judgment of the jury, will fairly and adequately compensate her for the injuries that she suffered. What injuries? the injuries that are as a result of the accident. And this is what they should consider: the extent and nature of the injuries, the reasonable value of the medical services, the pain, emotional suffering, lost income. The jury is being instructed as to the elements of damages that they are to consider to be awarded if they find negligence on the part of the defendant and that he owes her damages. Instruction number 26. Next we go to instruction number 30. Also a consistent instruction covering damages. Compensation must be reasonable. The jury is instructed by the trial court that they may award only such damages as will fairly and reasonably compensate plaintiffs for the injuries or damages legally caused by defendant's negligence. Once again, what are the damages that the jury is supposed to be considering? Totality of damages? Pre-existing conditions? No. They are instructed by the trial court only to consider those reasonable damages which were legally caused by defendant's negligence. And they cannot speculate, they cannot give conjectural or damages for harm which is not reasonably probable. They can only consider and award damages which were legally caused by the defendant's negligence.
Mr. Kodesh, was the jury ever told that their total damage award would be reduced by whatever percentage might be attributable to prior accidents or injuries?
No, they were not.
Did anyone argue the verdict form to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
And in argument, did anyone explain what the effect of the entries on the verdict form would be?
Not specifically. The position of the plaintiffs at the trial is that the evidence showed that apportionment was not applicable to the extent that under Montalvo, any pre-existing injuries that Mrs. Cotto had, and she did have pre-existing injuries. However, our view of the evidence and our position in presenting the case was that she had either recovered from these prior injuries or that they were dormant or latent at the time of the accident, such that our position and what we argue to the jury is that they should adopt the position that there is no apportionment.
So that the subject of the effect on an ultimate award of an active pre-existing condition was put to the jury. You simply argued eggshell plaintiff, in effect.
Not necessarily eggshell, but we.
I mean, a plaintiff who had recovered from or was asymptomatic with respect to any pre-existing condition at the time of the accident.
That is correct. And as to the issue of whether or not the subject of apportionment was brought up to the jury and what would happen as far as any percentages on the verdict form, it brings us to our next instruction, which is instruction number 31. And this is the instruction that is modeled after the court's decision in Montalvo and tracks the language from Montalvo. And it's a critical instruction, and perhaps from our standpoint, the most critical instruction in this case. And there's certain words that are very, very important in the analysis in this instruction and in the ultimate application by the trial court, as we will see. And without reading every word, but the important things is in this instruction, number 31, which is the instruction that the jury is given, which explains to them what apportionment is all about and what they're supposed to consider and how they're supposed to consider it and how they're supposed to arrive at their determination of damages. And what they find, what they're told, what they're instructed, is that in determining the amount of damages, if any, to be awarded, first of all, they must determine whether she had any injury or condition which existed prior to the November 2nd, 2001 incident. And if so, then they need to determine whether she was fully recovered from the pre-existing injury or condition, or whether the pre-existing injury or condition was latent when? At the time of the subject incident. Not at any time in her life, not 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, not as a child, but as Montalvo specifically states, you view the plaintiff and you take into consideration what her injury status or condition is at the time of the subject incident. And the jury is given a definition of what it means to have a latent pre-existing condition. And if they find, as we argued at the case, that she was fully recovered from the pre-existing injury or condition, and she did have, the record is clear, that in her history of her lifetime, she had some injuries that were either the same or similar to those that she presented at the trial. Okay. But the position of the plaintiff and her experts were that those injuries were either recovered or latent at the time of this accident. Yes, Justice.
You know, I'm not sure if I understood Justice Holmes' question. He asked, I think, whether or not the jury was advised that the damages would be subject to apportionment, and were they advised that it would be decreased? I mean, was he that specific?
Yeah. He asked me that question, and I believe that...
And he asked if you argued or someone argued the verdict form.
Correct.
You know what the problem is in this case for me is that there is no record as to whether you or Ms. Akaya argued the verdict form, explained it to the jury, that the percentage of apportionment would reduce the amount of damages and so forth. And what you would like to see in terms of, normally plaintiffs would argue that, right? This is what the loss of income is. We ask for this amount. This is what the medical damages are. We ask for this amount. Now, the question is, did the jury make an apportionment prior to or pre-existing? Did the amount, what was it, $59,000?
Correct.
Was that amount already reduced by 90%? Isn't that the basic issue?
Not necessarily 90%. The basic issue is whether the amount that the jury wrote on the verdict form, if was to be reduced by apportionment, had been...
Your claim is that it was already reduced.
Well, not necessarily. What I'm saying to you is that the jury took into consideration whether the amount of damages that they awarded should have been reduced. They may have adopted the plaintiff's position that she did not have an act.
I think there may be a semantical misunderstanding here. I think what the Chief Justice is asking is whether the mechanics of reduction in the event that the jury determined that there were non-latent pre-existing, that there was damage present at the time of the accident because by virtue of pre-existing conditions that weren't latent, was explained to the jury.
And I think I understand what you're asking, and my response would be that that is specifically covered by instruction number 31. And when we went over this jury, and when
there's a misunderstanding here. Isn't your position, or wasn't your position at the trial, that the jurors were unanimous in telling us that the amounts that they had written in question number 2 were already reduced?
Correct.
In their apportionment analysis. That was my question.
Yes.
Isn't that your position?
Yes.
Okay, so the question for me is, I mean, we don't have transcripts, you see. So if we look at the specific damages that were assessed, for instance, lost income, $9,606. And we take what your position was that it was already reduced by 90%.
No,
so
not
what
90%.
Was the, not, what was the
not
total amount? Well, okay, just tell
Let's
me.
Talk what about that
the,
one.
What does the evidence right. indicate right. was the amount that you claim for loss of income?
Let's use this one as an example, lost income.
Yes.
Mrs. Kato requested lost income for a period of time which spanned 20 months and 2 weeks. At a set rate of compensation, which was stipulated to by the parties what her monthly rate was. So, for example, we asked the jury to award her compensation totally in the amount of $86,019.18.
We don't have that before us because we don't have the transcripts.
But here's something that you do have. And in the briefs, and this is straight from the
briefs
appellant's
are not
briefs.
Part of the record. It's argument, right?
Well, Mr.
Kodesh, this is a big problem for, I think, the court, right? We don't have the record before us. There's no transcripts. We don't understand what the amounts were specifically that you claim for. You tell us in argument, but that's not appropriate. We would like to see it in the record, and we don't have that.
The appellant, Mr. Kaya, in his submission and in his on the record on appeal, indicates that with respect to the lost wages, since we're using that as an example right now, that their expert, Dr. Morrow, took the stand and testified that although Mrs. Kato
is that in
was
the transcript.
It's in the record.
When you say the record, what are you referring to?
Dr. Morrow's testimony is in a transcript that's in the record.
I don't believe that when Mr. Kaya referred to it in his brief, he talked about the settlement conference statement.
But the
and
briefs
the,
are not part of the record,
right,
Mr. Kodesh. The transcripts are the record, right?
Yes.
You can't bring in evidence to us through your briefs. You're supposed to have the transcripts as part of the record. And so what you're arguing from, when you tell me it's in the record, you're referring to briefs.
would the amount that the counsel requested from the jury to be awarded make a difference?
I'm sorry?
Would the amounts that the counsel requested to be awarded from the jury make a difference?
If you show it to me in the transcript as to and based on the record for other transcript exhibits that were admitted into evidence.
I think that one of the important points to bring out here is that in the instruction number 31, what you find is that on the issue of apportionment, what the jury was clearly instructed is that if they found the plaintiff was not fully recovered and that if she had a pre-existing condition at the time of the accident, and if they were going to consider apportionment and if they were going to award damages, they were clearly instructed that they must limit their award to the damages attributable to the injury caused by the defendant. Those are apportioned injuries. So in response to the question that Justice Acoba asked me is, if I go over the jury instructions or the court tells this to the jury, they are clearly instructed that they are supposed to apportion damages and write down on line number 2, where they give the damages, only those damages which are attributable to the injury caused by the defendant. They have to limit their award. That's their only choice. So if I get up on final argument and I go through this with them and I say, you consider apportionment, we don't think it's applicable, but if you do, you will limit your award, and on line number 2, you will write only those damages that are attributable to the negligence of defendant. And then I go on to say, and if you write a percentage here, then the judge is going to take the damage that you already limited and already reduced, and he's going to reduce them further. Because that's, in effect, what happened. So it would cause even greater confusion.
Let me ask you this. I want to ensure that I understand your position. Your position is that The instructions cumulatively correctly state the law. They fully apprise the jury as to its function with respect to reduction. The special verdict form was consistent. I mean, the words on the special verdict form were consistent with the instructions, and therefore, under no circumstances could it be appropriate for the trial court further to reduce or to impose any reduction on the amount that the jury awarded in the special verdict form.
I agree with everything that you said, except that questions 3 and 4 on the verdict form were not consistent with the Montalvo instructions. But the jury was clearly instructed that they were to consider only those damages that are attributable to the defendant, not total gross damages, not damages for pre-existing conditions. If you're going to do what the judge did in this case, you can't give these instructions. You have to have a verdict form that says, we want you to consider all damages of any type that existed before, both before and after the accident, and write a total amount of what those damages are. Then write down what percentage you would attribute to defendant Funari, and I will make the deduction for you. These are totally inconsistent, having an instruction which clearly tells the jury that you are to consider all of this award to the plaintiff only the damages attributable to the injury caused by the defendant, which we must assume that they did, because the jury is assumed to have followed the instructions that are given to them. There's no evidence to the contrary. And then the court takes that amount, which is already reduced, and apportions it again, based on questions 3 and 4, which don't track Montalvo, which talks about injuries and pain, which doesn't talk about damages.
How do you explain the court's decision then that $59,000 must be 10%.
Right. I have a difficult time with that. I think what happened is the court did some reverse logic engineering, saying that the jury awarded $60,000 and then they determined that 90% were pre-existing, although they never said 90% damages were pre-existing. The court assumed that somehow and said, therefore, 10%, that must mean the total damages are $60,000. But what you have to do is look at the verdict form, and you have to look at the way that the jury answered the questions. And
look at the instruction number 31. It tells you what the percentage means, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
If you look at instruction number 31, doesn't it tell you what the percentage that the jury found means, 90%, 10%? He's asking, or he's directing them in instruction number 31, to apportion the damages, right, by percentage. And if you can't do it roughly.
Right. It doesn't actually say percentage, but they're supposed to determine what portion are attributable to the defendant. And what they write on the verdict form is only that, the already reduced damages. There would be no reason to take an apportionment on damages that are already apportioned. And if you look at the verdict form, you see that the jury is asked to answer the questions in order. So when they consider this, they look at the negligence, they look at the legal cause, and then they look at damages. They write down the damages. So they went through this whole analysis, they apportioned, they determined what portion of the injuries is attributable to the defendant, they wrote that amount down, and then they get to question number 3, and they say, what the heck is this? Were any of the injuries or pain suffered by conditions which existed and were symptomatic before the accident? When before the accident? It doesn't say at the time of the accident. 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, how long before the accident? And if she had those conditions, yeah, she had some conditions before the accident. Did she have some injury to her wrist, to her mouth, to her neck at some point in her life? Yes. So that forced them to write 90% down, not intending to say that those injuries should be broken down, that 90% of the injuries that she sustained were from the time of the accident. I had reserved some rebuttal time, if I may, and I'd like to respond to the appellee, if I can, afterwards. Thank you.
Mr. Kaya, call us a couple of days before concerning his injured leg, which is in a hair cast, and ask permission to sit apart. You have that permission.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Without apportionment, I take it. How's it, Joe?
I didn't hear it. I think when we get into this case, Your Honors, the court has hit the nail on the head. The plaintiff or the appellant had the obligation to furnish the court with the trial transcripts if it was going to, if he or she, well, if they were going to argue that somehow there was a problem with the way the jury interpreted the instructions. As Mr. Kodesh has aptly pointed out, the instruction itself says that they are to apportion, and the question was whether or not they were going to apportion. As far as the issue about that was raised by counsel just now about the wording of the verdict form, that was something I wanted to address in the context of this argument, because Rule 49 required that the question be brief and susceptible to a brief categorical answer. And that's the reason why I believe that question was phrased the way it was. I had gone through my notes to try and figure out what happened, and I would note that in reviewing the record that the court can review, the plaintiff initially submitted a verdict form that did not have any apportionment questions. We, on the other hand, did. How that, and if the court were to look at our form, the form that we filed with the court, with the trial court, it says injuries and damages on the apportionment question. How that became pain and injuries, I'm not that certain, quite frankly, 4 years later. And we have no transcript of the discussions that occurred in chambers to settle the verdict form itself. The other comment I had on the idea that the wording of the verdict form was somehow inadequate was that if the court looks at the transcript, which I believe is Appendix 1 to the reply brief, of the hearing that we had that settled the instructions as well as the verdict form, the arguments that were being made to Judge August below was that the plaintiff either wanted multiple apportionments for various conditions or injuries. So in other words, he wanted multiple questions about apportionment, which the judge correctly rejected, I believe, because that by itself would have been very, very confusing. Or the plaintiff wanted no apportionment questions at all and simply wanted the court to presume that the ultimate number, what the amount that was awarded in response to question number two, would be the total verdict, without ever knowing whether or not the jury had apportioned or not. The problem, obviously, with that is under Rule 49, the issues of fact, such as apportionment, need to be addressed. And that's the reason for the inclusion of the apportionment questions in the verdict form. The other argument the plaintiff consistently makes in this case is that...
Can you expand on that argument? If the court already tells the jury that you do the apportionment and all we want on the verdict form is the damages attributable to the defendant, why isn't that good enough? If we tell the jury to do it, we presume they do it, and we tell them, just give us the end number or the ultimate award. Why is that wrong?
Well, because the Rule 49 provides that the factual issues are going to be determined by the jury. apportionment was a prime factual issue in this case. Although I think Justice Moon has pointed out that there is no trial transcript, there's certainly no transcript of the final arguments being made. I can tell the court that it in fact was a critical part of my final argument, and that although I did not go through the special verdict form, believing that to be the plaintiff's burden as opposed to mine, that we wholeheartedly embraced the idea that a majority of plaintiff's complaints post-accident actually stem from long-standing conditions that were neither dormant nor latent at the time of this accident.
Questions 3 and 4 on the special verdict form are the apportionment questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you respond to Mr. Kodish's criticism of question number 3, specifically with respect to the phrase "before the accident"? Did you understand that phrase to be synonymous with "at the time of the accident"?
When I believe at the time that answer the question was drafted, Your Honor, it was at the time of the accident. Yes, and the reason.
Do you think that before the accident and at the time of the accident are unambiguously synonymous?
Your Honor, no. However, I would point out that the actual instruction, the Montalvo instruction, correctly states the law on what dormant or latent is and what is apportionable or isn't apportionable.
Well, Mr. Kodish's argument, if I understood it correctly, is that if the jury were to respond to question 3 as it is posed literally, it would not be giving an answer that provided a number reflecting the amount of damages at the time of the accident that were caused by the defendant and were not non-dormant or non-latent.
Well, Your Honor, my response to that, again, is the Montalvo instruction, because they're told in that instruction what they can or can't apportion. They're given a...
They're being asked a question in question number 3, and they have to answer the question that they're asked. And they're being asked whether any injuries or pain that were suffered after the accident that were caused by conditions that existed before the accident, regardless of whether they were latent or dormant or not. Isn't that what question 3 asks?
Which existed and were symptomatic before the accident. That's correct, Your
Honor. Any time before the accident?
Well, again, it's difficult, Judge, to argue this because there is no transcript of the final argument. But
the final argument have clarified this from the transcript?
Yes.
Why did you order?
I didn't order it because it's the appellant burden under Rule 10 of the Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure.
You had the opportunity, if the transcript would have supported your position, right, to order the transcript.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree with that. I agree with that idea, with the exception being that they're making the appeal. So if they want the court to consider what would have been information the court would have liked, apparently may have liked to have considered, which would be that transcript, they have the burden rather than myself.
But would a transcript necessarily conclusively clarify the issue? I ask rhetorically, because the jury still is faced with a question on the special verdict form. The question on the special verdict form has the same significance as a jury instruction, and it's the obligation of the jury to answer the question it's asked, regardless of what the parties argued. Isn't that true?
That's true, Your Honor. That's absolutely true. And all I can say is that the transcript itself, I believe, would have furnished the court with information that, in fact, during the course of probably my closing, we talked about that dormancy, latency, because, this was, from a medical perspective, an interesting case because she had many conditions that mimicked the type of injury claims she was making prior to the accident. So it was very important for me to go through that in my closing as far as trying to explain to the jury why, given the instruction that we had, why apportionment would be applicable.
Mr. Kaya, do you think the jury would have been able to draw the relationship between the question on total damages and the question on percentage that the court did? In other words, would the jury be able, you think, to discern that there is a relationship between question 2 and question 4 and that the damages awarded in question 2 would be reduced by their answer to question 4?
I think what the court's asking is whether or not the jury should be allowed to shape whatever their factual findings may be to arrive at a number that they may want the plaintiff to finally obtain. I don't believe that's the purpose of the verdict form itself or the instructions of the court. The jury is meant to be the fact finder.
Assuming that's true, presuming that the jury followed the instructions, question number 2 would then reflect what damages they felt were attributable to the defendant after ignoring or deleting or not considering the prior accidents.
Yes, I believe the trial court was correct in that thought also, that question number 2 was meant to determine what were her total damages absent apportionment.
Well, that wasn't my question. My question was, wouldn't that be consonant with the instruction, the damages that were attributable to the defendant only?
Oh,
if they couldn't draw the relationship.
I believe that, you're asking whether the jury would have been able to draw the relationship between their percentage apportionment and the total damages? Again, Your Honors, I don't necessarily believe that it would be proper for the jury to understand that what they perceive as being the total damages that Mrs. Cato may have been entitled to.
Mr. Kodesh says the instructions of the court already told them. You excise the prior accidents, and all you put down on the damages question, in effect, is what is attributable to the defendant.
And I think the assumption being made is that is about the jury's thought process. In other words, how they may have viewed those the instructions.
So just so I understand, you view the word total then as being inclusive of pre-existing injury.
I'm not sure that I follow you.
What were Cato's total damages? You view the word total as intending to include all manifest injury post-accident, including that attributable to pre-existing condition.
Yes. Yes.
Was there any evidence of the damages from pre-existing conditions in the trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Dr. Marwell testified at length during the trial, but because...
As to loss income and property damage, et cetera?
The property damage was, by agreement, going to be exempted from any apportionment. As far as lost income, during the course of the trial, I believe Dr. Morrow indicated that, you know, the reasonable period of time for someone to recover from a soft tissue injury such as Ms. Cato had, in his opinion, was 3 months, which is why I believe they simply agreed with Dr. Morrow.
$9,606 equivalent to 3 months?
Yes. Because I believe the stipulated amount was $3,000 per month. And
see, this continues to be a problem.
I agree, Your Honor.
What we're doing is we're speculating.
I agree. And again, all I can do...
Actually, what you're saying is for the loss of income, the figure actually reflects 3 months following the accident. So that's 100% due to the accident your client caused.
Then that wouldn't be the total damages, which would be inclusive of the accident plus prior incidents.
Right.
No, what I'm saying is what the jury felt she was entitled to as far as a time period to be off work for any reason would have been 3 months, because that's generally... I mean, that's basically what Dr. Morrow said. Now, how much of that was caused or attributable to her general condition even before the accident? That's where, you know, Dr. Morrow indicated that he felt that it was a 90% apportionment because of, again, we don't have the transcript before us. I can only advise the court that he felt that, you know, she had psychosocial factors that impacted upon her recovery that stemmed from other reasons.
I'm sorry. Mr. Kodish indicated that the loss of income claim was $89,000, I think, that he made during the course of the trial. Right? Do you agree with that?
I believe that he, at closing, he asked for about that much. Yes, Your Honor.
Looking at the, I mean, if we had that evidence, and looking at the apportionment that the jury came out with, the $9,000 that they found and they placed in loss of income is about 10% of the $89,000. And that would be reflective of a pre-apportionment that Mr. Kodish's position was at the time of trial.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, but there were, again, opposing arguments, and we don't have the transcript in front of us. If I may, you know, the idea that the trial judge conducted a second apportionment, he simply followed the verdict form. And as the court pointed out to plaintiff, the evidence would have never supported a $600,000 award. The plaintiff never asked for a $600,000 award. So although the plaintiff chooses to call it reverse engineering, it was simply, I believe the trial court, simply trying to point out the absence of logic to the plaintiff's position that somehow the $59,000 total damages pre-apportionment was meant to be what the jury wanted to award.
You're focusing on question number four now?
Yes.
Question number four speaks to condition, injuries or pain suffered by conditions which existed and were symptomatic before the accident. Where in the special verdict form is the jury expressly asked to quantify the plaintiff's injuries and pain existing and symptomatic after the accident?
They weren't. They weren't.
Well, your position is that the special verdict form is clear on its face, and Judge August simply applied did the math that what the plaintiff was entitled to was the total number of damages reflected in question number two, discounted by the percentage appearing in question number four. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, where does the special verdict form instruct the jury to do that?
I don't, again, the verdict form, my understanding of the purpose of the verdict form was to answer the factual issues that had been raised at trial. If we were to have tried to, you know, I had a far lengthier special verdict form, but that had been rejected. If we were to, you know, the instructions are the instructions. They instruct the jury on how to apply the evidence to the law. The verdict form itself is meant solely to get their answers to whatever factual issues.
Well, question number three asks whether any injury or pain was symptomatic before the accident. The answer was yes. And then question number four asks, well, what percentage of the plaintiff's damages were symptomatic before the accident at any time? And the answer was 90%. So based on that information, what authorized Judge August to do a reduction or an apportionment?
Well, I can't speak for Judge August, but I believe that the percentage affixed to pre-existing conditions authorized Judge August to reduce the judgment.
But the problem is that, at least as I read the special verdict, nowhere is the jury asked to quantify the plaintiff's damages as of the time of the accident.
Again,
gross.
I understand. And all I can say is, Judge, that the instruction itself, the Montalvo instruction, indicates that they're supposed to be considering what is not dormant and latent at the time of the accident. So as far as the issue about time, you know, at the time of the accident, the assumption that I think we all have to make is that they went back and looked at the Montalvo instruction.
Well, the jury could have understood the instructions completely and followed the instructions completely to dotting every I and crossing every T. Yet the jury was still required to answer the questions it was asked in the special verdict. And the jury was nowhere in the special verdict asked to quantify the plaintiff's damage as of the time of the accident. And without that information, how is it possible to do an apportionment or a discount?
Well, again, I can only go back to the instruction as well. The instructions the jury had when they went into that jury room and answered these questions. I understand that the court may be asking me, how do we? The other way of looking at it is, how do we know that In response to question number two, what are the total damages that the jury may have? As I understand, you're talking about at the time of the accident, is that right?
Right.
Okay.
I mean, maybe I was inartful. I suppose cumulative amount reflected in question number two, or in answer to question number two, would be, it's unclear. I mean, if as you say, and as Mr. Kodish argues, the jury followed the instructions, it's as likely as not that the jury already deducted any damage resulting from a non-dormant or non-latent pre-existing condition. But question number three doesn't ask whether any of the above injuries existed already when the accident happened. It asks whether any of that damage or injury existed at any time before the accident. And the answer was yes. And then the question is, well, how much of the plaintiff's damages existed at any time before the accident? And the answer was 90%. Well, what do you do with that information?
I believe what the court did, what Judge August did, is he simply applied it, because, again, the logic of it would simply be, as Judge August pointed out when this was argued below, is that there was no evidence supporting anything, any other alternative. In other words,
yeah. Was there a lot of evidence indicating the similar type of injuries before the accident as after the accident? Was there a lot of evidence from experts or from the medical records indicating that she had some of these injuries pre-existing the accident?
Yes.
How close up to the accident?
Well, if you believe Dr. Morrow, up to very shortly before.
And we don't have that.
And we don't have that.
I mean, as part of the record, is what I'm saying. But if we look at the amounts that were assessed, and we indicate, I don't know if I misspoke. I'm not sure if $89,000 that you referred to, Mr. Kodish, was for medical specials or loss of income.
Loss of income.
Loss of income. So the $9,000 loss of income is approximately 10%. So, you know, just looking at the figures, I mean, not knowing what's in the record, what, you know, kind of evidence was presented in terms of medical. I mean, it's just difficult to understand if the jury, except for the loss of income, now it seems close that maybe they did pre-apportion the damages.
With respect to, I think the fact that...
Excuse me, let me ask you. This case went to arbitration?
Yes.
And the amount was, 160-something thousand?
Yes.
Was there a apportionment given by the arbitrator, do you know? I'm just interested. Curious.
At the time that the case went to arbitration, I don't believe Dr. Morrow had expressed his opinions. So I don't believe the arbitrator had anything before them. If we're talking about what transpired in the arbitration itself, I can only tell the court that in my second day of this trial, I happened to run into the arbitrator, Ms. Green, who, while we were walking to lunch, said that why are we in trial, and expressed that she thought that maybe she had made an error in the arbitration award. But, you know, be that as it may, I've never brought that up because, and it's, again, it's not part of the record, and it wasn't something that I needed to hear in my second day of trial.
Just to clarify, Rule 49 It was entirely discretionary with the court, right? The court does not have to give special instructions.
Yes.
And even if it does give, a special verdict form, the form of the questions and the number of questions and the type of questions are entirely discretionary with the court.
Yes. And we did have proposed forms. I think the court tried to find a middle ground between what they were proposing.
Anything further, sir?
No, thank you.
Mr. Kodesh, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but previously you tried to explain to us why $59,000 does not represent 10% of damages?
Yes, potentially. And I'm going to get to that. The first thing that I'd like to say is, Justice Moon, your point about not having all of the trial transcripts and all of the testimony of the witnesses to be able to view and see what they said is a point well taken, and I do apologize for that. On the other hand, and I mean this with all due respect, I don't believe that this appeal and the issues that are presented before you should turn on what any one or two witnesses said at the trial or even what arguments were made by counsel. Certainly, even if we had the entire transcript of the trial, it would not include those deliberations that took place in the jury room, which perhaps is critical to your analysis here today. And what we believe is that this case doesn't turn on how much money I asked for or what Dr. Morrow said she was entitled to. This is a case about law. This is a legal issue, not a factual issue. This is a legal issue about applying jury instructions to a verdict form to a judgment and what path that must focus. And it's purely a legal issue. It doesn't matter. In fact, the judge instructed the jury. He said, it doesn't matter what the lawyers say to you. It's only argument. I am the judge, and I will instruct you on the law. This was instruction number one. And you must follow those instructions. Whether you believe them or not believe them, I am the judge. This is the law. You must follow the law. And what is the law that the judge gave them? He said that you must consider all damages, yes, but you are to award only the total damages that you attribute to be caused by the negligence of the defendant. That is the only thing that Mrs. Kato is entitled to. When you write down your number of damages on question number two, that number is the apportioned amount. This is undisputed. He agrees, I agree, Judge August agrees. Instruction number 31 tells us that. There is no question.
What are you asking this court to do? Confirm or affirm the $59,000 as having that's the amount that is due and owing to your client?
Seems to me there's three options. One is we conclude that the jury followed the instructions, as they're presumed to have done. Kawamoto, Myers versus South Seas, you give the jury instructions to the jury, it is presumed under the law that they followed them. There is no ambiguity in these instructions. The instructions are good. Montalvo is still a good case, still good precedent law in this state. That's one of the questions that we're asking you.
We know the presumption.
Go ahead.
So
if it is, then it is clear that the jury apportioned, they limited their award to the damages attributable to the injury caused, and there should have been no apportionment taken. So you would vacate the judgment, you would remand it with the instructions that the judge would enter judgment in favor of the plaintiff in the amount of damages awarded without taking the reduction. Now, if there's some ambiguity, if you believe that perhaps the jury didn't apportion, they didn't, as Judge August clearly concluded. He clearly concluded by taking an apportionment that the numbers in question number two had not already been apportioned. Then you must conclude that the jury did not follow the instructions. And what is the remedy for that under the law in the state of Hawaii? Remand for a new trial. Or if there's number three, we don't know. He says maybe they apportioned, maybe they didn't. We just can't tell from the state of this record whether the jury apportioned or not. Then the remedy under that under the state of Hawaii again is remand for a new trial. Basically, in our mind, There's no question.
A new trial on liability and damage?
I'm sorry?
A new trial on liability.
Only on the damages. We were awarded a directed verdict on liability. There would be no question to revisit that. That's not a factor of this appeal. In fact, I would also go in to say that we wouldn't get another shot at the loss of consortium, because that was already concluded by the jury. It would be strictly the damages that Mrs. Kato is entitled to receive. But when you have a case like this, and the instructions are good, and they are clear, and they are unambiguous, and the jury is presumed to have followed the instructions, then the only conclusion that we can reach is that the amounts that are put into question number two are apportioned. Questions three and four had no place on the verdict form. The instructions were good. The verdict form was bad. We could live with the verdict form because there is some discretion that goes with the court, and that's clear. However, when you take that verdict form and you use that to apply a 90% reduction to damages that had clearly already been reduced, then you've caused irreparable harm and prejudice to the plaintiff, and that's what occurred in this case.
Thank you to both counsel. We take this matter under advisement.